Jesus spoke it, and it happened. Read with me from John 2. On the third day, a wedding took place in Canaan in Galilee. Jesus' mother was there, and Jesus and his disciples had also been invited to the wedding. When the wine was gone, Jesus' mother said to him, "They have no more wine." "Dear woman, why do you involve me?" Jesus replied. "My time has not yet come." His mother said to the servants, "Do whatever he tells you." Nearby stood six stone water jars, the kind used by the Jews for ceremonial washing, each holding from 20 to 30 gallons. Jesus said to the servants, "Fill the jars with water." So they filled them to the brim. And then he told them, "Now draw out some and take it to the master of the banquet." They did so, and the master of the banquet tasted the water that had been turned into wine. He did not realize where it had come from, though the servants had drawn the water new. Then he called the bridegroom aside and said, "Everyone brings out the choice wine first, and then the cheaper wine after the guests have had too much to drink, but you've saved the best till now." Thus, the first of his miraculous signs Jesus performed in Cana in Galilee. He thus revealed his glory, and his disciples put their faith in him. John 4:45. When he arrived in Cana, the Galileans welcomed him. They had seen all that he had done in Jerusalem at the Passover feast, for they also had been there. Once more he visited Cana in Galilee, where he had turned the water into wine, and there was a certain royal official whose son lay sick at Capernaum. When this man heard that Jesus had arrived in Galilee from Judah, he went to him and begged him to come and heal his son, who was close to death. "Unless you people see miraculous signs and wonders," Jesus told him, "you will never believe." The royal official said, "Sir, come down before my child dies." And Jesus replied, "You may go, your son will live." The man took Jesus at his word and departed. And while he was still on the way, his servants met him with the news that his boy was living. When inquired to the time when his son got better, they said to him, "The fever left him yesterday at the seventh hour." Then the father realized that this was the exact time at which Jesus had said to him, "Your son will live." So he and all his household believed. This was the second miraculous sign that Jesus performed, having come from Judah to Galilee. Pastor Blaine?
John wrote this down. On the third day, there was a wedding in Cana of Galilee, and the mother of Jesus was there. On the map, Cana is where the red star is. Notice, too, that it is not terribly far from the Jesus places that we have visited the last 2 weeks. The Sea of Galilee is there. And up the coast of the sea a bit is Capernaum, the place where Jesus took up residence after being roundly shooed from his hometown of Nazareth. Prophets generally do not do well in their hometowns, is what Jesus had said upon leaving, and it had only gotten worse from there. So today we have Jesus over to the west a little in Cana at a wedding. We do not have many of the wedding details, but what it does say is that Mary was there. Mary was already there ahead of time, and if we follow along further, we do find that Jesus' mom was getting rather directive. Mary appears to be the one in charge, giving Jesus things to do, the way moms at weddings are prone to do even to this day. Mary was directive. Things needed to be orchestrated. So perhaps, maybe, it's a family member that's getting married in Cana, one of Jesus' siblings, perhaps. or a first cousin. Whatever the connection, Jesus has been invited to the wedding, and he also has been asked to bring his disciples along. So the guest list at Cana's wedding took a quick uptick, and then Jesus turned the water into wine. A lot of water was turned into a lot of wine. A superfluous amount of water was turned into a superfluous amount of wine. And Jesus was behind it. He instigated it. Jesus was the one who pulled it off. And after all was said and done, verse 11, it says, Jesus' glory was revealed and his disciples believed in him. And so many questions to ask, especially for those of us who brag about never having tasted wine and seem to be quite proud of that fact. This scripture taunts the attitude of teetotalers. Jesus turning water into wine, and that because of it all, his disciples believed in him. Now, for today's lessons, I have two questions. One is a fun question. The second one is more of a geeky technical question. So the fun question is, how many of us have ever been converted to Jesus at a wedding? How many of us have moved closer to Jesus at a wedding? Okay, here's the geeky techno question. Why did John write this episode down and Matthew, Mark, and Luke did not? Why is John the only one who says, all this water into all this wine reveals his glory? What's up with John? What's John getting at? What do we think about it, Mennonites? Let me begin with the second, more technical question first. Since we are spending some time this summer in Jesus' geography, which means sort of putting aside some of the miracle talk for a second, which means putting aside, for the moment, atonement talk, because Jesus is very much alive in time and place, very different from ours. Jesus is alive and well in a place called Cana. So the second question, why does John include the wedding scene in Cana? The others do not. Let us geek on. To begin with, I would like to fuss with kind of a fancy word. The word is rhetoric. Have you ever heard of this word? We usually think rhetoric is with speech making, which is partly true, but it can also refer to writing, even John writing down his gospel. When we look up rhetoric in the dictionary, it offers this. The art of effective or persuasive speaking or writing, especially the use of figures of speech and other compositional techniques. Compositional techniques. There is a Bible scholar named Ben Witherington who has done a lot of work on ancient rhetoric, both Bible rhetoric and Roman rhetoric, because in Jesus' day in Roman circles, the art of rhetoric was a very big deal. You went to school for it. Speech-making techniques were studied and they were learned. They were then, and they still are. Did you know that to begin with, Adolf Hitler was a terrible public speaker? He was the blah, blah, wah, wah speaker bore if there ever was one. Could not gain a political ear in Germany if he tried. No how, no way. Until he went off and learned some rhetorical skills. He took lessons, and he got much better at the art of persuasion, the use of voice and gestures, and emphasis for public speaking. He learned that, and we all know where that went. Dr. Witherington's work on ancient rhetoric is helpful. He identifies three kinds. Here they are. He identifies the forensic type. This would be like law court speech making. Think the way lawyers talk. The art of attack and defense. This kind of rhetoric is focused on things that have been done in the past. Something has happened. And if you like to watch courtroom dramas on television, if you've watched opening and closing statements or cross-examination of a trial, you've watched a kind of forensic rhetoric, the art of attack and defense. Think Johnny Cochran, focused on things done in the past. Another type of ancient rhetoric would be called deliberative. This is the kind of speech found in many public settings. This is the kind of speaking about offering advice and considering consent to what has been said. It was used in democratic assemblies, the kind of talk that would come before a vote. This is a kind of speech that has the future in mind, to advise and to point forward. Some preaching does this. The preacher preaches, listeners listen, glean what has been said, and moves it off into their futures. Deliberative rhetoric. Our car salesman used this on us last week. Advice, leaving the door open to consent. Speech making. All right, one more. This one is both ancient and is still present with us in several forms. It is called epideictic rhetoric. This kind of rhetoric is a little overboard on style and a little lean on content, maybe. Think commercial television ads. You've heard the term flowery speech. Epideictic is the kind of speech you might hear, say, at a wedding toast, a speech leaning more into honor, leaving out some of the other stuff. Or epideictic speech might be given on the occasion of a graduation. How many of those remember the last graduation speech you heard? How many of you were converted to anything at the last graduation speech that you heard? This kind of rhetoric might be called more a flourish of style than substance of what is said. Maybe at a funeral, where a friend of mine once observed that eulogies tend to make heroes out of scamps. Rhetoric of display. So there's forensic, which deals with the past, deliberative, which is in the present, wanting to influence the future, and epideictic, which is more a flowery speech. And so we could ask, if this is the culture in which John is writing, if this was the Bible era in which John is writing down his gospel, what kind of speech writing was he using? Of all the stories of Jesus that John had to draw on, and there were a boatload of them, I think this verse ought to be underlined in all of our Bibles, John 20:30, where it says, "Now Jesus did many other signs in the presence of his disciples, which are not written in this book." Of all the stories of Jesus that John could have used, why did John select this one? The wedding at Cana. What did he want his audiences to know about Jesus? Did he want them to know that Jesus was a magic man? A traveling rabbit out of the hat water to wine magic show? Is that what he was after? Meant to wow audiences in Cana and beyond? Was John an epideictic writer, simply using a nice wedding scene to wow the reader, to flower the reader? Probably not. I do have one more entry into the Jesus geography puzzle for this morning. I've got a question for you. It's kind of a culture question. How many of us, if you've been invited over someone's house for dinner, will ask, "Is there anything that I can bring?" Go on, be honest. And if they say nothing, just bring yourselves, and you cannot help yourself, but you want to bring a little something anyway. Wrap it a little gift, a jar of jam or bread, and add it to the meal, because you can't help it, because it seems like it's the right thing to do. My two sisters came by last Saturday and stayed overnight. Now, they didn't ask, but Crystal did come bearing some fresh coffee beans and scones. My sister Gay brought along some fresh blueberries and set them on the kitchen counter, because it is the guest thing that we think we need to do. Think about Christmas. We do gift exchanges, right? I mean, nobody wants to go to a gathering and only receive gifts. We think we need to take something too. It's called the custom of reciprocity. Now, we know that Jesus wasn't Mennonite. And the Bible wasn't written by Mennonites either. It wasn't. John was written by John. And so then what about the world that Jesus walked in Cana of Galilee? Before there were democracies, before there was a free market economy, as we know it, people got by in the world by using the you scratch my back and I'll scratch yours method. Give and take, the art of exchange. We've heard the phrase, there's no free lunch, or you don't get something for nothing. Back in that day, there were patrons and there were clients. And if the patron gifted you with a favor, you'd better be thinking about a way to soon return the favor. It was expected, and it was offensive if you did not make a return. It's how things worked in the empire in John's day, the give and take way of life. It was an exchange economy. So now, if you are John and you are in the process of choosing some of the many episodes that Jesus did, what kind of rhetoric are you going to use? Are you going to use flowery speech? No. Are you going to use courtroom evidence speech? Well, maybe a little. Or do you want your people, your readers, to hear and to deliberate and to decide and to eventually follow and trust Jesus? And how will you begin to break into people's hearts who know only one way of doing things, the give and take method, the you don't get something for nothing way of doing life? How do you communicate Jesus to I'll scratch your back if you scratch mine, to the payback culture that expects a fair favor in return? Well, John tells them about a wedding incident where there was a miracle. But it was more than a miracle. It was more than a Jesus hat trick to get his mom out of a jam. It was about an abundance that comes from God that you can't pay back. A multiplied abundance that you don't even have to try to pay back. That if wine does indeed gladden the heart, like it says in our Psalms, then think about how many hearts 150 gallons of wine will gladden with no paybacks. That if wine was simply meant to slake a thirst, then how many wedding party guests could be slaked by 200 gallons and no returns necessary? And if wine was a celebratory drink, then how many guests could stick around to celebrate? What if John was using his story to say that about Jesus, that he is not a magic show, but that his magic is a sign that could be trusted with no paybacks? What if John used the wedding story to help people understand the largesse of God's good? All right, let's circle back to the fun question. How many of us have been converted to Jesus at a wedding? How many of us have seen a glimmer of God at a wedding? Quite a number of years back, I was asked to do one for a couple of locals back north. The couple had come asking, mostly it was him this time. She was sort of being quiet and hanging back and letting him do all the talking. We sat down together in our church basement to do some premarital work. Some of it was the usual stuff that you talk about: communication, finances, who will be responsible for what. But before long, I began to notice a certain intensity in him, and in her, there were all of these huge, silent question marks of reluctance. Intensity in him because this was his second go-around at marriage. He had been jilted the first time and suffered depression along with suicidal thoughts because of it, and it had been a terrible stretch for him. And so his intensity was born out of urgency, a wedding urgency, wanting to get it right this time, darn it. She was more reluctant, way, way more reluctant. Found it difficult to do any talking, difficult to even think about planning the wedding. It was like she was just playing along with whatever. She had not been married. She had been in two relationships previously. Both ended with a guy moving out and moving on. And so she wondered, will getting married be any different than that? how can I expect anything to be different? The wedding day came. A tiny country church was full. But how to say this? How to say this without offense? There are weddings that are on the high end of proper. If you watched the May royal wedding of Prince Harry and Meghan Markle in St. George's Chapel in Windsor's Castle, you witnessed social etiquette at its highest degree, with well-timed processionals and hats and dresses and deference, with the proper seating arranged well ahead of time. I would say that this wedding was at the other end of that spectrum. Many of the guests had never been to a wedding before, let alone been in a church. And for all intents and purposes, it looked like dress down day at the park. Folks wore what they owned. What else can you do? And there was so much talking going on. No one knew quite what to do or expect of this thing. There was this certain awkwardness that filled the church. There were flower girls, 10 of them, along with their 10 mothers sitting near the front to tend and to hiss their instructions throughout the whole ceremony. Cattywampus wedding comes to mind. Well, they say that you can tell a lot about a person's eyes. And it was true on that wedding day. For despite the dull din of the little overcrowded church, despite the unsettling shuffling noises that were ever present, who kept glancing around to see who was there and experiencing the awkwardness of attending a wedding for the first time, it was the eyes of the bride and groom that told the tale. In a sea of averted faces and awkward glances, it was their thirsty eyes that kept straining forward, straining and searching for trust, for retrust in something, God in heaven, anything, for someone. And they used the words of their vows and the tears of their hopes to trust this one on this day, this time, on this afternoon, going forward. So yeah, back to the fun question. Have you ever been converted at a wedding? Have you ever caught a glimpse of God at a wedding? Or was it simply a flowery affair? It happened in Cana, where some invited wedding guests that go by the name of disciples caught a glimpse of glory, and it changed them, and it persuaded them to follow Jesus further beyond Cana. And unless I've missed my guess, that is why John chose to front end his gospel with this story of a wedding scene for us to consider our options, to stack up all of the options that we have in front of us, and to deliberate the Jesus who operates out of an abundant and crazy grace where there are no paybacks needed, and to see where it will go long after the wedding is over.